This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Studying Media Critically, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm your host, Gummo Clare, and today I'm joined by Mark Anthony Neal, who is James B. Duke Distinguished Professor at Duke University. We'll be talking about his fascinating book, Black Ephemera, The Crisis and Challenge of the Musical Archive, which was published in 2022. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, as always, I'm going to start with a biographical question. So could you tell us a little bit about your background and your path into scholarship?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in the place that we affectionately call the boogie down Bronx, working class parents, uneducated at the time, but a very musical household in very different and complex ways. My dad was a big fan of gospel quartets and quintets, so there was a lot of Mighty Clouds of Joy and Soul Stirrers, Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers in particular in the house. And he also liked the Hammond B3 guys. So there's a lot of Jimmy Smith and Jimmy McGriff and obviously some B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland there. My mother's listening tastes were a little different. We listened to a lot of Shirley Caesar on the one hand. Her favorite artist was Aretha Franklin, but there were a lot of the soul men of that era, the Teddy Pendergrass, the Al Green, the Luther Ingram, the Isaac Hayes, the Marvin Gaye. In many ways, her listening practices were the building blocks of the kind of work that I would ultimately do, you know, as a kind of writer and critic and scholar of Black popular music. My path started in graduate school at the University of Buffalo, where, of course, we tragically, lost so many folks in that shooting, a place that's still very dear to my heart. But my career began at Xavier University in New Orleans, which is a historically Black college university, moved on to the University of Albany, and then for a short stint at the University of Texas at Austin. And I've been here at Duke now, in the Department of African-American Studies for the last 18 years.
And so what drew you to writing this book specifically? I know it builds on some themes that you've touched on in the past, but what is it about this project?
You know, this kind of idea of archives, and it's been something that I've been kind of ticking about in my head, I would say for a good 15 or 20 years, but I never thought of it as a project about archives. I'm not trained as a historian. So when I hear archives, right, and I'm not obviously someone working in museums. So when I hear archive, I think about very traditional notions of archive in terms of boxes and stacks of paper you know, photos and all those kinds of things. But, you know, what I began to realize that as I began thinking about this work, and particularly the earliest moments of this work, was my fascination with the Stax Recording Company. You know, the well-known, you know, black music label that specialized in Southern Soul, really the Southern Soul counterpart to Motown, you know, which I actually would more describe as a rhythm and blues label as opposed to a soul label. But, you know, Stax loses because of a bad contract and situation distribution deal. You know, 1967, 1968, Stax loses the totality of their archive, right? Basically lose it to Atlantic Records. And Al Bell begins this process of rebuilding Stax, right? And I realized at some point that what that was an archival project, right? You know, how do you rebuild the archive from scratch, which is what he did. And he did a bunch of strategies, from expanding the range of things that that black music could talk about in terms of infidelity and politics, expanding the sound of black music at the time. So whether that's taking the Staple Singers from the work they were doing as gospel folk singers and making them kind of cutting edge soul and funk artists in the early 1970s, to those lush arrangements that we get from Isaac Hayes, you know, beginning with Hot Buttered Soul, which literally changes the sound of soul music, you know, going into the 1970s. So it was really kind of thinking about all these other different moments of stuff that have been tossing around in my head. And this idea of Black Archives helped me to kind of bring all of those ideas together, you know, under one project.
So I'd actually like to start at the end of the book before we dive into the kind of body of it. Because in the coda, you write that for every movement forward, there are necessary returns to the archive, which feels to me a little bit like a kind of mantra that animates a lot of the project. Could you explain exactly what you mean with that phrase?
Yeah, you know, it's a couple of things, right? It's, you know, obviously being a scholar of black culture, black popular culture, and someone who's also been able to dabble a little bit in terms of popular journalism, as either whether music journalism or cultural criticism, and reading so much of the work that's being produced now in this moment where in many ways ideas have been democratized, right? You know, so many online sites publishing good and not so good work, so many people writing about so many things. And just generally as someone who loves the culture and actually loves reading criticism, just a sense that as we go forward, that folks who are writing and some of the most visible people writing about Black culture don't actually have a great handle on the archive. And coming through at this particular time when it's a moment where if you're a young writer, there's no guarantee that your editor is going to be any older than you are, right? You know, because all of the seasoned editors have been pushed out of the industry, right? There's no one, there's no, you know, fail-safe system to say you need to look at this, this, and that also, because your editor doesn't know either. And so part of it for me was to think about as we build this enterprise of Black cultural criticism, that it's important as we write forward that we continually have a relationship with the archive, with the stuff that's going before. For me as a scholar, it's that recognition at that point of my career, you know, I'm 56 years old now, I've been doing this for 25 years, that my value in the enterprise now is not necessarily writing about a new Kendrick Lamar album, right? But actually building out and sustaining the archival work that needs to be done, right, to guarantee as folks go forward as writers, right? And I'm not just talking about myself, you know, I'm talking about a generation of folks in this regard, that continuously we have to go back and build and feed upon the archive to make sure that the archive can still sustain, you know, the body of work that's being produced going forward.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and you say you're not trained as a historian, but this book, you really, you know, it's meticulously researched and you really draw these, it's the sheer density of connections, I think, that really comes through in a lot of these chapters that, again, it really demonstrates the need for this work and the need for that contextual information, I think. And then, so the other kind of focus here is on ephemera. So how are you defining that and what does this focus offer?
Yeah, you know, for me, ephemera is this thing, you know, in the context of the book and talking about archives, the kind of stuff that we don't pay attention to, right? That we think of as almost throwaway culture. You know, on the one hand, it's old Black people keeping photographs and other kinds of knickknacks under their bed, right? And for folks who do archival work, right, they're not thinking that there's any value, right, you know, to these things. You know, growing up in the houses I did in the Bronx, you know, my parents had these pens, you know, from the Poor People's Campaign and all kinds of, you know, in retrospect, stuff that didn't make any sense to me, that didn't have any real connective tissue. And for me, it was easy to think of that stuff as just kind of excess, as throwaway, stuff that doesn't have any value. And I really want to on the one hand, be self-critical of myself for thinking about those things that way. You know, part of this book is actually bringing together some of that connective tissue. But the way that Blackness more broadly is treated as toss-away or throw-away culture, right? As ephemera, literally, something that's produced, it gets consumed, and folks move on to something else, right? And, you know, I think one of the attributes of Black culture that continues to be a challenge is this idea of simply treating Black culture as a mass consumable, as simply a form of entertainment that can be consumed and moved on, and not to think about it as a culture that needs to be sustained, that needs to be archived, right? And the word that I use throughout the book needs to be carefully curated, right, for that sustainability.
Yeah, and I think that the figure of the curator or the notion of curatorial power is something that comes through repeatedly, either, you know, and not, well, actually normally in the hands of cultural industries intermediaries who do not have the best interests of, you know, popular Black culture and its careful curation at heart, right? And one challenge that you kind of return to throughout the book is the implications of shifts in curatorial power brought about by digitalization, right? That's kind of a touchstone throughout. I wonder if you could chat about that slightly, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes we forget because it's so easy now to access so much. You know, there's a way in which Black culture, broadly defined, is more visible and more accessible than it's ever been. I mean, it literally is, you know, at a finger's touch. One of the things I don't think we pay enough attention to is that, you know, who and what, in fact, has the ability and the capacity to hold all of this data, right? I mean, that it is a literal kind of functional question, right? Who can maintain all of this data? And the reality is it's always going to be global corporations and institutions, right? You know, there are really few Black institutions that have the capacity to maintain and curate that level of data. And so what that means is that now that the data is so, and by data, I'm not obviously talking about, you know, just the one and zero in the sense that we think about data, but really thinking about culture more broadly manifested as forms of data, you know, big Black data, as I talk about, you know, in the intro to the book, you know, as we grapple with the accessibility of this data, right, it really means that we have to do additional work, right, and additional labor. So on the one hand, you know, be able to curate this data where we can, right, where we see fit, where we can fit in, and also do the work of naming the kind of cultural DNA from where it comes from. I use in a kind of fleeting way the example of someone like Beyoncé, right? Now, I don't spend a lot of time talking about her in the book, but there's a way in which Beyoncé historically has trafficked, you know, in the archives of Black culture, right? Whether it's the obvious references to Josephine Baker, might be obvious to us, not obvious to everybody, right? So she's pulling from these different kinds of forces, right? And remaking it in this world of Queen Bee. And I think it's important that folks know where she's drawing this stuff from. To her credit, she's been very good, right, in terms of identifying the source material, if you will. Not everybody is as good and has that level of integrity in terms of the places that they're drawing from, to the extent that they even know what it is that they're drawing from.
And I suppose, obviously, a key touchstone here, which again comes through in the book, is I guess, sample culture quite broadly conceived, right? And this idea of a relationship with the archive that does pay dues without kind of an over reverence. And I think I'd be interested to hear you reflect a bit on that, on, I guess, yeah, this interplay between acknowledging where the material has come from without it becoming kind of overawing. And I think there's a number of examples of in the book that you kind of raise where they seem to manage that quite well.
Yeah, you know, Black culture is rife with examples of sampling culture, right? We tend to talk about it most in the contemporary moment and around hip hop. And to be honest, we talk about it in the context of hip hop really because the ownership of the source material, right, tends to be owned by these huge corporations, right, who you know, beginning in the early 1990s, really, on the one hand, criminalized the use of some of the source material, and then erected these elaborate schemes, right, in terms of how much it would cost, right, to be able to use these things, right? And what is necessitated in terms of hip-hop culture producers in particular, our strategies, right, whether it's shop and screw and all kinds of other things, you know, as workarounds, right, this kind of intellectual propertyization, right, of Black music, right? So that's one, you know, contemporary example of it. But, you know, you go back to the 1940s and bebop artists are citing and sampling Tin Pan Alley tunes, right, in the middle of their songs as improvisational solos, right? You know, the practice of blues songs, right, that get remade over and over again and refashed for different generations. You know, I talk about, you know, the relationship of Victoria Spivey's music, you know, to another blues artist, and he literally borrows, right? And they recall, right, the conversation where he asks, right, I'm going to do this to your song, right? And she's always like, you know, whatever he does, right, he can never replicate that moan of mine because that moan of mine is so personal, right? So, you know, it's rife with all these kinds of different examples. And I think sampling for me is an important practice because it really is, on the one hand, ancestor worship, right? It opens a portal, you know, to an earlier history. You know, part of my interest even in this work, you know, comes from listening to, you know, particularly the sample based, you know, producers of the 1990s, Pete Rock, Ali Shaheed Muhammad, you know, those generations of cats, right? You know, what's his name? Q-Tip, you know, who all delve deep, right, DJ Premier, into this kind of soul jazz catalog, right, of the 60s and the 70s, right, and opened up a portal, right, for so many folks to not only consume this music, but also to build generation connections, right, with their fathers and their grandfathers, right, who listened to that music, right? So it's this kind of place where hip hop and jazz came together very palpably, really, you know, for a 5-year period. You know, so I'm a big supporter of those practices, you know, in that regard, and particularly when there's ability to name and cite, you know, if not directly where the source material is from, right, because that's always a big conversation in hip hop, but also just to name the cultural moments, right, that these things are being drawn from. And I think we just simply do less of that work now. You know, I was surprised, for instance, in some of the initial responses, you know, not so much of the Kendrick Lamar album, but the first video that he did, which, of course, you know, borrows liberally from Marvin Gaye's I Want You. And I was just surprised how many young folks hadn't heard, you know, the original Marvin Gaye sample, right? Which, you know, it is an iconic piece of music from an iconic Black performer, right? In my mind, that's the kind of thing that, you know, should be a lingua franca, if you will, you know, within Black America at the very least.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And before we get any further, I also wanted to ask you a bit about your kind of method for this book. How did you go about writing it? Because there's such a huge amount of granular detail that underpins stitching together the kind of the micro, but also the macro, right? You're often going from these talking about interiority to huge kind of conjunctural discussions. So I'd just be really interesting to hear how you went about doing the research and how you chose and also excluded the music that you refer to.
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So there's a way in which I lived with this book for at least a decade, you know, before it was published. The real intense writing of it, you know, really pretty much occurred between 2018 and 2020. You know, pandemic, of course, you know, put some of this stuff on the shelf for a little while. But, you know, for me, I'm always writing in bits and pieces and fragments. And some stuff will show up as kind of public facing pieces that I might do for a publication, or more than likely, you know, house on my own website, you know, as a way to kind of think out loud, right? And as the project goes forward, I start to kind of pull these pieces together. You know, so the first chapter, you know, the chapter on Stacks, you know, as I mentioned, is something that, you know, has since up my first book, What the Music Said. I was just fascinated with that question of what Stacks, you know, was, what it lost, what it became, right? And my remembrance of Stacks is not the earlier Stacks, right? But the Stacks of the Watch Stacks era, right? And I was just simply initially interested to figure out, how do we go from Jim and Estelle, right, to two white folks who found the label, to Al Bell, right, and Watch Stacks, right? And so I was really, on the one hand, just doing a kind of musical history of that period of time. And obviously there's great work already out there on Stacks, right, and trying to find a way to bring something a little different to that. And for me, it was really looking at some of the artists that we don't pay a lot of attention to. You know, a kind of deeper read of the staple singers. You know, you have to talk about Isaac in some way, but to be able to talk about the Soul Children, you know, a group that's also heavily sampled, right, in hip hop culture. The group that was most important for me to write about, the Rance Allen group, right, simply because of where they start and how Rance Allen, you know, was a fairly well-known, you know, gospel star. You know, at the time that I'm writing this book, I didn't tell this story in the book, but I was traveling actually to give a talk at the Stacks Museum, probably 2018. And as I'm flying, you know, out of dorm, right, Riley dorm to Memphis, you know, there's Rance Allen, right, getting on the same airplane, right? And you know, I'm telling them, you know what, I'm actually going to give a talk at Stacks about you, right? And he was, you know, glad to hear that this very early part of his career, you know, still resonated in some ways. Some of the other chapters, like, you know, the second chapter, you know, which looks at this experimental novel by Ricardo Cortez Cruz, you know, I first taught that novel shortly after its publication in the late 1990s, and I always wanted to write about it, but I didn't know how to, right? Again, I'm not a literary scholar, so I wasn't going to use traditional literary theory and criticism. But as time went on, and the magic of the internet and the digital began to reveal itself to me, what I realized what Ricardo Cortez Cruz was doing was that he had in fact written a pre-digital hypertext novel, right? Where this short 125 pages, the characters primarily speak in song lyrics, right? And the job of the reader is to be able to go in deep, right? Unlink the, you know, the hypertext that aren't actual hypertext, right? Because it's print. And for me, that was extraordinary, right? Because it allowed me to recognize what he was trying to do and find another way in. And then lastly, I mentioned, you know, chapter four, which is a chapter on Aretha and Marvin. I always felt as though we had given short shrift to Aretha Franklin's career prior to Atlantic. You know, quite honestly, I find the work that she did collectively at Columbia a little bit more satisfying and appealing than the stuff from Atlanta. One, because I grew up with so much of the stuff in Atlantic, but she is really doing some extraordinary things and taking extraordinary risk and covering an extraordinary range of material. You know, whether it's her covering, you know, Hank Williams Sr., you know, as one example, or singing all of these Clyde Otis, you know, songs, or being produced and arranged by Bobby Scott. I wanted to talk about that work, and the best way to talk about it was her tackling of this concept of the American Songbook, right? This, you know, iconic archive of great American songs, right? That we typically associated with, you know, white Jewish songwriters, right? And white jazz vocalists, right? Particularly Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and folks like that. And what did it mean for this 19, 20 year old black women, Black woman, to not only go into that archive and record these songs, but actually reclaim them and rename them in ways so that, yes, she could sing Hank Williams and she could sing Tony Bennett. She could sing People, right, which she actually recorded at the same time that Streisand did, but no one heard her version, right, for another 30 years, how she could sing all of these songs, right, but none of those artists could sing an Aretha Franklin song. And then Marvin Gaye, who at the same time, you know, comes into his career wanting to be Frank Sinatra, right? He wants to record his version of Wee Small Hours in the Morning, but he's at a company that needs to sell records, right? And he has a bunch of hit records, and his brother-in-law, right, who owns a label, is telling him, you ain't singing that stuff. And so he secretly, you know, begins to record these songs with Bobby Scott, who gives him seven songs in 1967. And he literally plays around with these songs, you know, for the next decade, you know, particularly once he creates his own studio, Marvin's Room, right? And Drake gives the studio a literal shout out, right, in 2011 with the song Marvin's Song, Marvin's Room, which he recorded in Marvin's Room. And I talk a little bit about that, you know, in the book. But where he workshops these songs, right? And as the technology changes, what he's able to do with those songs changes as he gets older and experiences a different kind of life, right? You know, deepening his experience, those songs change, right? And so, you know, as again, someone who's not trained as a musicologist, right? I can't tell folks, right, given my training, what they're hearing and why these notes are important. You know, shout out to the great Andrew Flory, you know, who as an ethnomusicology ecologist is doing extraordinary work on exactly these Marvin Gaye songs. And also my friend, you know, Harry Weinger at Universal Motown, who made so many of these, you know, existing tracks available, you know, for public consumption. You know, that was the way that I could write about it. But, you know, if there is a kind of patron saint to this book and its work, it's John Okomfor, you know, the British Ghanaian filmmaker, Smoking Dog Films, right, you know, who gets his start, you know, with a collective, the Black Audio Collective in the early 1980s. And of course, Okomfor does this amazing film, you know, The Last Angel in History, you know, which is really, for me, the defining metaphor of the book, right? This idea of a data thief, right? You know, which could be a DJ, could be a sampling box, right? It goes back and forth as to, you know, whether or not it's an actual person or a thing, but this entity that is traveling across digital history, right, and reclaiming aspects of Black culture, right, and putting it in its proper context, curating it and archiving it, right, you know, and literally stealing it, hence the term data thief. You know, it's a film that just blew my mind when I first saw it in the late 1990s, and I was happy enough to, you know, mature as a thinker, as a listener, right, and more importantly, I think as a viewer, right, both in terms of watching moving images, but also visual culture, right, to be able to write about, you know, this extraordinary work that Okomfor has laid down over the course of his career.
Yeah, and I think if that's the kind of, I think you said patron saint or whatever of this book, I think also key there is your willingness on occasion, where the archive is already ephemeral or patchy, to imagine and you know, speculate slightly and draw connections that aren't necessarily totally there, but to kind of further enrich in the archive. And I really, that's something that I found really amazing and refreshing about this, how you're alongside all of the, you know, again, granular documentary evidence of these recordings and this workshopping or whatever, then occasionally there were kind of leaps of imagination that would just fully flesh out the story, or not even story, but kind of the point, I think. And yeah, I think that that's a fantastic aspect of the book as well.
Thank you.
So, I mean, just to jump to chapter four, actually, which you mentioned there, you touched on, you know, Aretha Franklin reworking the Great American Songbook. I wonder if you could talk maybe about some of the implications that you draw from that about her, the kind of approach to genre, kind of crossing and reworking, and what that kind of the politics, I guess, of that.
You know, we talk all the time, and it was her mantra when she was alive. It's the way that we always described her, as a queen of soul. And I actually feel that that is limiting in thinking about who she was and her contributions, right, to American music. if not global music on some level. I think the only way to describe Aretha Franklin is as the greatest vocalist of the 20th century. The range of material that she covers, how she takes on that material and remakes it as her own, you know, just as a passing moment, you know, Dionne Warwick is a bona fide star in the 1960s. You know, she is, as a solo Black woman solo artist, the most successful Black woman solo artist of the 1960s, right? You know, everything that we think about Beyonce now that we thought about Whitney Houston in the 80s, that's who Dionne Warwick was in the first part of the 1960s. And for Aretha Franklin to be able to take on, right, Dionne Warwick, you know, first low-keyed suddenly, like with her remake of Walk On By. But then you take a song like I Say a Little Prayer, right, which is this major hit, right, for Dionne Warwick. And then Aretha and Sissy Houston and them get in there, the Sweet Inspirations, and they're just playing around, right? Just playing around with a little piano riff and different kinds of harmonies. And it's like, there's no comparison between the two songs, right? What Aretha does is a different song, right? You know, you hear Dionne, it's like, this is nice. You hear Aretha and the Sweet Inspirations, and it's like, whoa. This, and she does that time and time again throughout her career. And it seems that, you know, her strategy, right? And you know, this, I lament that I never actually got a chance to talk to her and ask her about strategy, right? When she chose what she recorded and why. But she seemed always to be able to try different genres and styles of music in an attempt to achieve some level of mastery. And then once she achieved that level of mastery, she Aretha-sized it, right? So that it became an Aretha moment. You know, so, you know, Coco World, you know, which is a Hank Williams Sr. song, right? You know, which then gets covered, you know, by the great Dinah Washington, right? You know, Aretha, of course, records her version on a tribute album to Dinah Washington, right? Dinah Washington is one of these people that she had to go through, right? Was a mentor of some sort when she was a girl, you know, coming to her father's house, you know, in Detroit. And she goes through Dinah to achieve a mastery of what Dinah Washington was singing and then goes on to something else. And Coco World is such a great example of this, right? So in this one shot, right, she takes on Hank Williams, right, the King of the Country Blues, and then takes on, you know, Dinah Washington, the queen of the blues, right? And you know, creates this moment that you actually hear in Cold Cold World, the future of Black music, because you hear the future of Aretha, right, in that song, right? And she just does that throughout her career. And it continues on when she becomes famous, right? You know, we all talk about Amazing Grace, right? And I lamented, you know, when the film came out, because I was deep in the book, right? When they finally released the film version of Amazing Grace, and I was deep in the book at that point in time, and I was trying to figure out whether or not I wanted to incorporate the film into the book, which I eventually chose not really to do so. And then I also, because I've been living with this soundtrack, right? This Aretha Franklin Amazing Grace soundtrack, I would argue that with the exception of maybe the Jackson 5's Maybe Tomorrow album, is the album I have listened to the most in my life, right? You know, beginning when my mother brought it home in 1973. That's just the nature of my relationship to it. And I remember lamenting not writing about it when the film came out because I was deep in the throes of the book. And I was like, I'll just wait. You know, to put all that stuff in the book. But the revelation to that album, you know, is really not that session. The revelation is her going to the Fillmore West a year earlier. Right. I mean, that's actually where the idea for the Amazing Grace album is born. And watching Aretha Franklin go to the Fillmore West with that audience, which is primarily teenage and early 20s, white cats, you know, hippies, as we would describe them as a time, long hairs, if you will, in introducing that audience to the spirit of the Black sanctified church. I mean, and, you know, Billy Preston said it best, right? I mean, just think about, first of all, who she has on stage with her. You know, her musical director is the great King Curtis, right? And you know, this was important for me on a personal level, right? As I write about in the book, you know, somewhere in 1971, I'm 5 years old, and my parents take me to 3 concerts. They take me to see, you know, the Gene Terrell-led Supremes at the Apollo. My mother takes me to go see the Jackson 5 at Madison Square Garden. And together, right, my parents take me to see Aretha Franklin at the Apollo, right, the great week-long stand that she did the Apollo in June of 1971 that stayed with me for my whole life, right? So that when I finally hear, as a kid, live at the Fillmore West, right, which was part of that same tour, when I hear Amazing Grace the year later, right, I already have a personal relationship with live Aretha, right, that's not mediated by recordings, right? But, you know, going back to live at the Fillmore West, right, here we have King Curtis as a musical director, you know, you got Billy Preston playing keyboards for her, like it's like a who's who in the band. And as Billy Preston described those 3 nights at the Fillmore West, he as he classically said, you know, the hippies flipped the fuck out. Because it was just something extraordinary and magic about that moment. And what was also extraordinary is that she wasn't just bringing that crowd to her. She met them on their own terrain, right? So when you hear her version of Stephen Stills, Love the One You With, or Bread's Make It With You, right? She's building a common ground. And I would argue, particularly with Love the Way You're With in the second night, not the first night, you know, she just takes the song and takes it elsewhere, right? There were folks who hear Let It Be, you know, during those 2 nights, you know, because she recorded it a year earlier, you know, before it was even known that it was going to be on the Beatles album, because she had got a copy of it, probably from Billy Preston, right? You know, so she's taken on, right, you know, again, her cover of Bridge Over Troubled Water, right? So she's taken on Lennon and McCartney. She's taken on Paul Simon, right? The who's who of these singer-songwriters, right? She, of course, had been gifted, right, a major hit from Carole King, who's also emerging as one of these figures in this kind of moment. She's becoming this figure who is covering the greatest writers and composers of the era and adding something distinct and unique to it, right? And part of what she's adding to it is the idea of the Black sanctified church. And then that last night, you know, Spirit in the Dark, right, which is, I would argue, is Aretha's original gospel recording. Right. It's not about church. It clearly is about spirituality. Right. And she's going through these church runs, right, introducing this audience to what a church experience is like, and then pulls Ray Charles out of nowhere. Right. And he shows up on stage and 2 of the greatest progenitors, right, examples of soul music are on stage together at the same time. And they take the song even elsewhere. Right, that's different than what Aretha imagined, right? You know, listening to, you know, Ray Charles get up there, you know, she's like, get behind the keyboard. He's like, I don't know this song. I don't know how to play this, right? Right. This ain't really my style, right? And they figure out a way to come together and create something out of it. And, you know, I mentioned Carole King a second ago. You go to Amazing Grace, that album, and when she does that mashup of You've Got a Friend and Precious Lord, again, elevating Carole King, you know, in her rightful place alongside the Lennon and McCartneys and the Bacharach and Davids, right? And the Pauls, Simon and Garfunkels, right? But doing so also lifting up, you know, the great, you know, Black father of spirituals, right? You know, Thomas Dorsey, a father of gospel music, Thomas Dorsey, and saying in that one moment, not only is Carole King great, right, but I'm going to elevate Thomas Dorsey on this same level, right? And most of y'all don't know who he is, but because I'm recording him, right, you should know that he's important and as important as Carole King.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And I think there's something really interesting there, isn't there, about the kind of the politics of citation as a kind of, yeah, as a kind of solidarity in a way of, I guess, to bring back curation. You know, that makes Aretha Franklin, as well as everything else in that context, being a kind of curator for the ends of, like, yeah, uplifting people that she sees as undervalued. And I suppose that's something that comes out very much throughout a number of these chapters, similarly to do with the kind of the cover as an act of claiming ownership while also uplifting and using citation as a kind of politics. So is there something maybe lost today when covering certainly seems to be much less prevalent in kind of contemporary pop recordings?
Yeah, you know, my issue with covering these days, right, and I'd love a good cover. You know, I have these playlists, you know, that have gotten me through life over the last 15 years, right? Especially in the digital moment, right? Because literally you can put anything in a playlist, you know, in ways that a 60-minute TDK or Maxell, you couldn't contain all the things that you wanted. But, you know, I have these playlists of like these different versions of Marvin Gaye's just to keep you satisfied, right? And it's amazing how many people have tried, you know, their hands at this, or Bridge Over Troubled Water was another example, right? So I appreciate a good cover, and the best covers are folks who can maintain and affirm why the song and the lyrics and the composition were important in the first place, but then also contribute to it in a way that furthers the greatness of the tune. I don't think we see a lot of that now. I think what we see now are people, you know, who can speculate what their audience knows or doesn't know, right? And do a cover, right? And move on, right? You know, so, you know, I've taken a lot of shots over the last couple of months, you know, with Silk Soul. One, you know, because I don't necessarily find the project all that interesting, right? And you know, I'm 56 years old, right? So why would I, right? It's not really intended for me, right? And honestly, you know, I understand the commercial rationale for it, right? You know, Bruno Mars, who, you know, is a gifted mimic. Let me just say that way, right? Extraordinary, actually, in his ability to mimic the music that he grew up listening to, right? So you hear him and you hear shades of New Jack Swing and you hear shades of Teddy Riley, right? You know what he grew up listening to, right? But he's also someone who needed some street cred, right? And Anderson .Paak gives him street cred. Anderson .Paak, who individually is an extraordinary artist in my regard, in my sense. Songwriter, drummer, obviously, but also as a vocalist. You know, he needed some pop shine, right? So the project, you know, I understand the commercial reasons for them doing it, right? But then when they do a song like Love Train, and, you know, and I understand I'm an old man, right? So I have a different relationship with this, right? But like, I listen to Confunction's Love Train maybe 3 times a month. That will randomly pop up on one or two, you know, playlists, right? So when I hear Silk Sonic singing, I'm like, why would I want to hear Silk Sonic sing it straight? Right? Yeah, the production is better, better instrumentation. I get that, right? But, you know, why would I do that if I can just go and listen to the original? And I think it puts, you know, some of the older artists in a really interesting space, right? Because I'm sure on a certain level, Michael Cooper would love for more folks just to listen to Confunction, right? But he also knows that no one isn't, right? And the fact that Silk Sonic gives him a shout out is important, right? I'm sure Frankie Beverly felt the same way, you know, about, you know, Beyonce doing Before I Let Go, right? Though, you know, I refuse to listen to the Beyonce version. I'm just, it's not the same, right? There's a communal aspect of Before I Let Go, right? That just simply doesn't get replicated, right? And I understand what Beyonce was trying to do, but you go to a black barbecue, black cookout, whatever your parlance is, and Frankie Beverly and Maze's Before I Let Go comes on, and everyone from the 7-month-old who's just learning how to walk to the 92-year-old who can never, who can't walk, right, is connected through that song, right? And there's so few examples of black music now that do that, right? That is, you know, I would argue the last black song that cut across multi-generations. So again, I appreciate the samples, right? But for me, I, in really the covers, but I need you artists to add their own kind of take on it to make it something unique, right? That heightens why the composition was important in the first place, why the song was critical in the first part, right? But to really articulate in a way that takes it further.
And I suppose, is this in some ways what one of the challenges of the archive, right? The challenges of hyper accessibility is that, you know, if I was an artist today and I had access to one of those playlists, you can listen to 10, 15 covers of a tune, you know, where else is there to go? I know this is a problem in jazz as well, that the jazz musicians feel like, how are you going to approach Cherokee or whatever else? Because not only can you hear Charlie Parker's, but you can hear every version done every year until 19, you know, whenever. Yeah, and I just wonder if that's one of the issues.
And I think that's, you know, that's a problem in the sense that so many contemporary, and I'll use R&B an example, so many R&B artists have become nondescript, right? Because as a jazz artist, you know, as just an example, and it's the reason why covers work the way they do in jazz, every horn player, right, just has a different tone. Right. There's a reason why we know why that's Wynton Marsalis versus that's Miles Davis versus that's Clifford Brown. Right. It's just 3 examples of trumpet players. Right. You know, so you can always bring your own tone to that. Right. Pianists have different kind of sensibilities around rhythm. We don't allow for that kind of diversity, I think, in pop music. Right. Pop music becomes this thing that we have a sound that's really popular, someone who sounds really popular. Let's find 10 other people, right, who can replicate that popular sound. And more importantly, that we can pay less than the person who created the sound in the first place. Right. So the economic stakes are as such in, say, popular music and R&B, you know, that it's worthwhile for companies to find people who sound like other people. Right, as opposed to really creating a lane where folks can be different and sound different and bring a kind of uniqueness to their sound. Right, and quite honestly, the people who have had sustainable, lasting careers over the last 25 years are really people who've created, you know, vocal sounds that just aren't you know, you just can't replicate them, right? Anybody can't do those Beyonce runs, right? There's something very, very unique in her own lane, right? And that's the reason why we talk about her the way that we do.
And I think one thing that the book does really well, actually, is you never shy away from that kind of the hard-nosed economics in the kind of eras that you look at as well. You know, in the soul period, it's, you know, Motown and Stax, you know, we're also trying to find their clones and trying to find, you know, someone who could be the next Diana Ross. And I think you highlight quite a lot of these sorts of figures as well, but how the artists you focus on find a way through those kind of economic constraints to be singular and to be expressive.
Definitely, you know, with the Stax chapter, you know, for me, ultimately the Stax story is a story about valuation. You know, the reason why they lose the archive in the first place is because, you know, Atlantic and Warner and other folks undervalued the archive, right? Even as they then took on the archive and immediately generated economic benefits from it. Right. You know, as much as we think about how great Otis Redding was as an artist on Stax when he was alive, much of the artist Otis Redding that we've come to know and talk about is stuff that was released after he died. Now, beginning with Doc on the Bay, you know, which literally was released a month after he died. So even as they were not willing to pay value for Stax, right, that would allow to maintain its archive, they didn't immediately benefit from that particular archive, right? And that's the story, you know, obviously of popular music more broadly, right? But it's the story of Black culture, right? Undervaluing in this moment, or, you know, I've been struck in you know, and particularly in talking about this particular archive, you know, Ernie Barnes is, painting Sugar Shack, right, just got sold for $15 million, right? And it's like, I'm not sure Ernie Barnes made $15 million on all of his paintings while he was alive. And clearly no one was trying to give him $15 million, you know, for that painting when he did it. I would argue collectively, when he was alive, you know, not only didn't Ernie Barnes make $15 million on that painting, Marvin Gaye didn't make $15 million on the album that features it as cover art. So you got this thing where the art is, in the case of Ernie Barnes, right, who was just seen as this kind of ghetto Black visual artist, right, you know, doing stuff that wasn't of any value in terms of high art. So his artistry is diminished while he's alive, right? And now a decade after his death, right, singular paintings are going for $15 million. I mean, we could have the same conversation about Basquiat, though Basquiat, you know, in many ways got much more, you know, affirming of his art while he was alive. But the prices that his art has gone from afterwards, right, no, his art was diminished in that moment in comparison to what the value of what it looks like now. And I think that's just a broad metaphor for Black culture.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And I think those stories do crop up a number of times in the book that kind of hammer that home. Looking at chapter three, where you discuss mourning and remembrance, you know, specifically in hip hop, in part, this involves some kind of reflections on the ambivalence of the video camera and video technology as a tool of documentation and surveillance in hip hop and African American life. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about this chapter.
Yeah, you know, so having lived through the early 1990s and the beating of Rodney King, the videotaping of it, remembering how significant that visual was, right, for folks in 1991, right, as was the visual of the shooting death of Latasha Harlins, right, shortly thereafter. And how we're now in this moment where we've been desensitized, right, even before George Floyd, from seeing Black people killed on video. And so on the one hand, I wanted to track our practices of reaction and mourning to these killings, right, over this 30-year period, right, how the culture responded to this earlier moment, right, in the case of hip-hop, right, and not just around these kind of very, you know, popular and signature shootings of Black folks, but also in terms of losses within the culture in that particular moment. And I think we tend to think about the hashtags and Twitter in this moment as something new. And I really wanted to make the argument that, that these practices of mourning in this digital moment, right? If we go back generations after generations, right? We see other mourning practices that, that are part of the culture. What Martin Luther King signaled for the culture in his death, and the number of artists who felt the need to you know, add a voice to that mourning, right? We know, obviously, very well, you know, Nina Simone, but much less the reaction of, say, a Max Roach or someone like that. You know, this didn't make it into the book, but even thinking about the jazz artists who memorialize, you know, the killing of George Jackson and the Attica moment more broadly, you know, that that we forget about in the context of the culture. And then to go back and see these other ways in which artists attempted to mourn losses. And, you know, one of the things that I never expected to find, right, the, one of the biggest surprises I found in the archive was, in fact, the Sam Cooke cover album of Billie Holiday songs, right? And I'll just be honest, it's not good, right? You know, if there were ever two artists, right, you know, because this isn't yet the change is going to come, Sam Cooke. I would argue that he gets to that, right, obviously because of the influence of Dylan, right? But you know, because he's also trying to tackle these Billie Holiday songs 6 years earlier, right, you know, he can't conceive of that, you know, in 1959, right? So this album is not very good. Right. But the tribute to her was important for him. Right. And the argument I make, you know, in the book is that, you know, he knew he couldn't pull off, right, Billie Holiday. Right. But he also knew Billie Holiday was not someone who could easily translate to mainstream and wide audiences. Right. That that she was, you know, there was something unique about her that was intended for a much more discreet audience. Right, than the mainstream would ever allow, but that his covers of her music, right, was a platform that would allow, just to be frank, white audiences, right, to be able to hear and listen to Billie Holiday in ways that was much more accessible to them than Billie Holiday would have been more directly. But again, in many ways for him, that's a tribute to who she was and why she was of value to him, just as it was when, you know, Berry Gordy decides after Sam Cooke's death that that it's not Marvin Gaye who's going to do the Sam Cooke tribute album. It's not the Four Tops or the Temptations that are going to do the Sam Cooke tribute. That is going to be the Supremes, right? So because Sam Cooke represented a crossover move to the Copacabana and all these kinds of things that Berry Gordy had envisioned for the Supremes, right? So it's a tribute to the path of Sam Cooke as opposed to the music of Sam Cooke in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that the whole section actually on the kind of slightly strange marriage of the mourning and tribute albums with the commercial imperative and Motown's kind of Berry Gordy's real understanding of the bottom line, I guess, is a really interesting section about, and again, by highlighting the ambivalence there of how these things can still be powerful documents of yeah, mourning and remembrance. Right? Yeah,
you know, the couple of things from that chapter, one that I ultimately didn't write about and the one that I did, I would argue that the centerpiece of that chapter is Danny Boy. And the first time, and it was an old English professor, and we were in class talking about Black music. This is, you know, when I was in grad school. And he mentioned Jackie Wilson's Danny Boy, right? And I was someone who thought that I knew Jackie. Well, you know, your love's lifted me higher than all that kind of stuff, right? To be loved. And I finally listened to Jackie Wilson's, you know, Danny Boy. And it's like, wow. What is the context in which this Black man from Detroit is singing this Irish hymn and does what he does with it, right? And then you go into the archive, it's like, well, hell, how many Black artists are singing this, right? Sam Cooke sang a version of it, right? The one that is most compelling and in comparison to you know, Jackie Wilson is Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, you know, singing this song, right? So I wanted to write about what a song like that might have meant collectively to the Black community, right? As a broader sense of a mourning song, right? In the absence of one that might exist in the tradition at that moment, right? As I also talk about the interesting dynamics between, you know, the competition between what it means for Jackie Wilson to sing that as the headliner, right? And for the Bluebells to sing that lower down, right? And the way that, you know, as I read it, you know, it seems as though, you know, Wilson wanted to punish them, right? Through an act of sexual violence, right? For taking his limelight for his song and his top billing. But the other pieces I didn't write about, because at some point I had to decide, okay, this book isn't really about me. But it's a song by Pete Rock and CL Smooth, They Reminisce Over You, right? And this is really the moment where the idea of collective generational mourning, right, for me became more broad, right? It's a song that I absolutely love. I often identify it as, for me, the, you know, hip hop's first mourning song, right, in that moment, and created a whole tradition afterwards, right? Obviously with Tupac's death and Biggie's death after that. But I was always fascinated by the sample, which I, you know, after years and before Google and all this kind of stuff, what I identify as Tom Scott's, you know, cover of a Jefferson Airplane song, right, to make it even more bizarre, right? And in a different world, if I was writing a different book, right, it'd be a whole chapter on the layers of this song, you know, the Jefferson Airplane original, the Tom Scott cover, and then, you know, where Large Professor, you know, tries to do something with this song and can't quite do anything with it, and then gives the song to Pete Rock, right? And then it becomes They Reminisce Over You. But there was an episode of The Boondocks. Riley was here, where the youngest brother Riley is doing this graffiti art around, extraordinary, like, artistic thing. No one believes it's him, right? Because they just think about him as a kid that's tagging up stuff. And so finally he paints this portrait of his dead parents. And so everybody recognized, oh, it was him. And then the scene, you know, who's teaching him to paint is this caricature of Bob Ross, right? The PBS Afro guy, you know, who's teaching people how to paint on public television, right? And they're driving away in a car as the police are trying to get them, right? And Bob Ross is like gangster in this episode, right? Because he pulls out his 45 and all this kind of stuff. But as that scene is playing out in this animated cartoon, they start to play the Tom Scott song. And it, for me, it was an extraordinary moment because there's only a small subset of people that would have connected that Tom Scott song to the sample from They Reminisce Over You to the larger theme of that episode, right? Which is, you know, Riley mourning his dead parents. And for me, it's like that level of intertextuality, right, really gets at the kind of stuff that I wanted to talk about in the project.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is a really good example. That would have been a great chapter. Because I think one thing that's really fascinating about the book as well is how kind of fluidly it moves in time period, right? Because I think every chapter, it moves between kind of a discussion in the kind of soul era, hopping into hip-hop and then hopping further back. And it feels entirely natural because that's how contemporary culture works, and that's how pop music, especially Black pop music, has really worked. And so it feels like the kind of register in which the book is written reflects the medium that it's speaking to, I think. And I think that's a good example as well, really. That touched on something I wanted to ask you about before, actually. In the start of the book, you talk about the challenges posed by the contemporary archive to the Black cultural critic invested in the continued work of mystification. And so I just wanted to ask you about mystification.
You know, I worry about, in particular in this moment when so much stuff is accessible, giving away the tools of the trade. I think the work of really good critics, regardless of genre or who they are in terms of their background, I think the job of a good critic is to mystify art, to add to the mysticism and the questions around art, first of all, to think about criticism as a form of art in and of itself, but as a critic, not so much to answer all the questions, but to raise more questions in the art. And I don't think we do enough of that, generally speaking, in cultural criticism in this moment. And I definitely don't see enough of that amongst Black criticism in this moment, right? I think about, and there are a lot of ways to go about that, but you know, I think about, again, the Kendrick Lamar album and just that video and people who are doing pieces basically to connect all the dots. Right. You know, I love close reading, right? I came out of a tradition of close reading. I can appreciate close reading with anybody, right? But close reading in the absence of actual narrative, right? And a speculation about why this is important, to me is not useful criticism, right? It's dead end criticism, right? It's criticism that it's ending the conversation instead of extending the conversation. So that when I talk about, you know, the need of critics to mystify art, right? It's about extending the conversation, right? As opposed to ending it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, really great way of framing it. I think, you know, asking more questions rather than trying to answer or spot all the connections. I mean, there's so much more to talk about. There's so much music in here to listen to, but you've been really generous with your time. I've asked a couple of people this actually, are there any specific tracks that you'd want listeners to this podcast to listen to coming away from this before they read your book?
Definitely Rance Allen's Up Above My Head is one of those tracks. Aretha Franklin's Cold, Cold World. You know, I won't pick one song from Marvin Gaye, but if you can get a copy of his Vulnerable album, to just hear the extraordinary work that he does with these Bobby Scott charts, you know, trying to become, you know, Frank Sinatra. I spend some time in the last chapter, right? Which in the last chapter is really a ride. I often use the last chapters of my book as a portal to the next project, right? Maybe not the next immediate project, but a project down the road. And I often like to use the last chapters as the chapters where I articulate all that I've learned in the process. And definitely the fifth chapter of this book does that. But I spent some time towards the end of the fifth chapter talking about Jimmy Scott. And again, you know, whether it's Jimmy Scott's Day by Day, you know, which is featured in the Denzel Washington film Fences, or the Folks Who Live on the Hill, those are, you know, tracks that I would definitely suggest people should listen to.
Amazing. I mean, and you kind of gestured towards it there, but what's next? What are you working on now?
So, you know, a bunch of things I'm thinking about. I really want to do a project that looks at some of these soul man figures of the 1970s, but that next tier, right? So not Marvin Gaye and Curtis Mayfield and all the folks that we should know, but folks like Luther Ingram, Walter Jackson, DJ Rogers, right? You know, folks that we might describe as Black famous, you know, who never really crossed over to the mainstream. And part of my argument is that one of the reasons why they didn't is because they represented certain kinds of ambivalences and anxieties within Black America that for them to become more mainstream would raise questions about Black America, right? So Billy Preston is really the one good example, right? They we really have not done the kind of work that needs to be done on Billy Preston, given his impact on the culture broadly, right? Whether it's as the Fifth Beatle and his own career and the places where, you know, he came up apprentice, you know, being an apprentice with James Cleveland, right? With Ray Charles, right? You know, not a whole lot of people can talk about that kind of level of relationship. So that's one of the projects, the most pressing musical project, at least that I'm thinking about, you know, in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's so much to be done there. That's
really absolutely exciting. Absolutely.
I look forward to reading it. Well, yeah, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Gamal.